The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, podcast listeners. Before we get to this week's episode, I want to recruit your help bringing the podcast to a wider audience. We've got a devoted listenership, but we want to grow and reach more people. We don't have an advertising budget. We work by word of mouth only. Your mouth. So please, take a moment to tell your friends on Facebook and Twitter and any other social media you might use about the Lawfare podcast. And even more importantly, please rate the Lawfare podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution service you use. It only takes a moment, and it'll make a big difference. Really.
There's a kind of division of labor which might actually be conducive to this kind of parallel tracks. The U.S. intervening from the air, the Iranians more substantially on the ground. The best case scenario for both governments, both Iran and the United States, would be an outcome in which ISIS is, if not eliminated, then weakened to the point where a revival is not imminent. We're in a better situation today than we've ever been in terms of dealing with the Iranians. We've got a viable diplomatic exchange, which has been ongoing now for the better part of a year. And it's actually produced an outcome which has withstood the test of time. And that, I think that channel and the fact that we've been able to see that the Iranians have remained committed to some of the obligations that they undertook as part of the interim nuclear accord really opens up, I think, the not just the opportunity, but the necessity of carrying on a much more extensive dialogue about what the future of Iraq may be.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 28th, 2014. That is my Brookings colleague, Suzanne Maloney, senior fellow in the Saban Center for Middle East Policy and a specialist on Iran. Like many folks, I've been thinking a lot about Iran these days. You know, nuclear talks, ISIS, sanctions, negotiations, that sort of stuff. Unlike most folks, however, I get to sit down with Suzanne Maloney and ask all the questions I've been thinking about. Suzanne's the editor of the Iran at Saban blog. She served on the policy planning staff at the State Department. We talked about the prospects for U.S.-Iranian cooperation in Iraq and about the likelihood of success in the nuclear talks and why Suzanne's surprisingly optimistic that we will ultimately see a nuclear deal. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 81, Suzanne Maloney on Iran.
So let's start with ISIS. We went from an environment a few months ago where people were talking about possible U.S. strikes on Iran to an environment in the last couple weeks in which people are all but talking about the U.S. and Iran intervening in a conflict on the same side. How much should we think about U.S.-Iranian interests as heading in the same direction here, and how much of this is a mirage?
I think there's a considerable degree of overlap between U.S. and Iranian interests in Iraq, but they're certainly not identical. And I think the intervention that we're not just talking about, but in fact seeing emanate from both governments is taking place in a way that's parallel, that is not yet coordinated, and that could easily come in conflict as well as find a way to work in a more harmonious fashion. And this is the real challenge that we have today. The Iranians, I think, are deeply troubled by the emergence and the empowerment and the march toward the Shia sections of Iraq of these jihadist groups. This is something that the security establishment has been talking about for several years. And I would argue, in fact, their concerns about ISIS and about some of these other Takfiri groups predated the shift in Washington's thinking about Syria and the conflict there from one of a democratic struggle to one of a potentially counterterrorism crisis. That's the way the Iranians have been thinking about Syria for quite some time. To see it spill over to Iraq, a country in which they have enormous political and economic investments, to see it threaten even the most important shrines in the Shia faith, is something that the Iranians take very, very seriously and I think extends well beyond the ideologues within the regime.
So you said that the interests are overlapping but not coextensive. Let's unpack that a little bit. In what areas are U.S. and Iranian interests, except, I mean, obviously in the broadest sense, neither of us like ISIS very much. But what are the areas where they're substantially overlapping, and what are the areas where they're really going to pull in different directions here?
I think the most obvious area of confluence is the fact that both the U.S. and Iran would prefer to have a situation in which there's a stable Iraq, which retains some degree of territorial integrity. That may be OBE or obsolete as we speak right now, since I think what we're seeing is already a partition of the country in a de facto sense. But both countries would prefer to see a situation in which the borders of Iraq, the legal borders of Iraq, remain intact and to the extent possible will be pushing for that kind of an outcome. The Iranians, however, have, I think, a very different sort of a backup plan. They're prepared to live within Iraq that is largely segregated by sect. They are prepared to live within Iraq that has continued to be led by Prime Minister Maliki. Whereas in Washington, I think that there has been long a readiness to see Maliki's time go. And obviously, over the next couple of days, as the Iraqis make some decisions, or they've been asked to make some decisions by Ayatollah Sistani today about the next prime minister, I think there will be, you'll begin to see these interests pull in separate directions. It's not that the Iranians love Maliki. In fact, they've had tremendous differences with him over the years. But he is their asset in place, and I think that there would be a great deal of concern about a situation in which you see flux at the very top in Iraq.
And why is it that the Iranians want a territorially integral Iraq rather than in one in which the Shia government has to make compromises with Sunnis and with Kurds rather than a Shia rump state that Iran can really exercise more control in?
Well, Iran exercises considerable control over Iraq as a united entity. And I think that they recognize the potential jeopardy both for Iraq and for Iran if we begin to see a reconfiguration of legal borders in the Middle East. Iran is, of course, a multi-ethnic and multi-sectarian state. They have their own restive Sunni population that at different points in time has, in fact, been radicalized by Wahhabist and jihadist influences coming specifically from the East. The concern would be that if you have a kind of Takfiri state somewhere in the region that is, in a sense, contributing to the destabilization of these provinces within Iran that have traditionally been somewhat difficult to subdue, I think that there would be a disinterest in seeing that happen. I think there's also a recognition that an Iraq that is truly divided among two or three separate entities is one in which the Shia state will be far more vulnerable to pressure from outside, pressure from the Saudis, pressure from Sunnistan or whatever it might become. Simply, the Shia portions of Iraq are those in which the bulk of the country's known oil reserves are located, but much of the oil infrastructure, including some of the major refineries, as we've already seen, could well come under the control of ISIS and other groups, and that would obviously leave a Shia rump state more vulnerable to external pressure.
So what's the best case scenario for this confluence of interests? I mean, the U.S. is getting involved. Iran is clearly involved. You said at the Iraq event last week that you saw a lot of opportunity for sort of parallel, you know, semi-coordinated or sort of action, but not a lot of opportunity for, you know, getting together and having a sort of joint plan. What's the sort of scenario in which you can really imagine the two sides kind of working together or at least working in parallel with one another?
Well, I think, you know, clearly there's a kind of division of labor which might actually be conducive to this kind of parallel tracks. The U.S. intervening from the air, the Iranians more substantially on the ground. The best case scenario for both governments, both Iran and the United States, would be an outcome in which ISIS is, if not eliminated, then weakened to the point where a revival is not imminent or not threatening the future of Iraq. And I think that, you know, that is in fact possible. We're in a better situation today than we've ever been in terms of dealing with the Iranians. It doesn't mean we have good relationships, but we've got a viable diplomatic exchange, which has been ongoing now for the better part of a year. And it's actually produced an outcome which has withstood the test of time and the opportunities for both sides to reconsider their obligations. And that, I think that channel and the fact that we've been able to see that the Iranians have remained committed to some of the obligations that they undertook as part of the interim nuclear accord really opens up, I think, not just the opportunity, but the necessity of carrying on a much more extensive dialogue about what the future of Iraq may be. The difficulty is we can't do that in isolation. We can't simply have a bilateral U.S.-Iranian conversation without engaging the rest of the region, precisely because all of our allies would find it deeply threatening to see the United States and Iran sitting down to talk in a robust fashion on that issue.
And what's the internal Iranian dialogue like about this? I mean, you know, working with us is at least as unpalatable to them as working with them is to us. I've seen some discussions in public about how reflecting a certain degree of discomfort with that. What's the internal Iranian dialogue like on this subject?
Well, the security establishment sees what's happening in Iraq, what has been happening in Syria, as the product of a deliberate attempt by the Gulf states, backed and supported by the United States and other Western powers, to weaken Iraq, to break up the Middle East, to regain imperial control over all the region's resources. That's the frame of reference that they have. They are deeply suspicious of the sort of anti-Shia impulses of this group and in many ways see it in parallel with the rise of the Taliban, which Washington initially greeted with at least some equivocation and even some encouragement. So that fed Iranian paranoia at the time, and I think that the parallels between these groups, the role of the Saudis and the close relationship between Washington and Riyadh contribute to the similar kind of paranoia that we're seeing today. For that reason, as well as I think the sense that Iran is the country that in fact knows the terrain, that has the influence, that has been active in Iraq and in many ways predominant in Iraq even before, but certainly since the departure of U.S. troops. It leads to, I think, a deep degree of concern about any kind of direct cooperation, even among those from more moderate, pragmatic factions within Iran. There is still, I think, a bitterness associated with the experience in Afghanistan, in which Iran assisted both militarily and diplomatically with the U.S.-led campaign to remove the Taliban and to establish a post-Taliban government under the leadership of Hamid Karzai. This is an experience that the Iranians across the board are convinced that they, in fact, did not benefit from. Despite making considerable investments and taking some risks, In the aftermath, the Bush administration sought to isolate Iran even further and branded the country charter member of the Axis of Evil. And all that, I think, looms in the backdrop of the way the Iranians would approach any sort of dialogue or explicit coordination on Iraq.
So as you've described, there is this ongoing diplomatic dialogue in the nuclear space that has been not unproductive and by some accounts is, you know, heading in a positive direction now. I'm curious, first of all, for your assessment of the state of that as things stand now, but also to what extent it is or is not linked either directly or indirectly to the Iraq situation.
The nuclear talks are, you know, at a crucial point. We're just about 3 weeks out from the deadline for negotiations as agreed under the interim accord signed last November. And I think there's really no sense of confidence that the two sides are going to be able to produce a firm agreement by that deadline, July 20th. There's a lot of brinksmanship going on both sides. The major outstanding issue is that of enrichment, which, of course, has been the issue really since 2006 when the United States offered to join the talks but insisted on a suspension of enrichment. So we're still sort of grappling with the underlying question of Iran's insistence that it ought to have an industrial-sized capacity to produce nuclear fuel and the international community's perception, largely driven by Washington's characterization of the threat that such an industrial size capacity would be a ticket to a nuclear weapons breakout capability. We just don't know what's going to happen over the course of the next 3 weeks. I think it's entirely possible the Iranians will produce some sort of last-ditch compromise solution that, in fact, includes some significant concessions on their side. But it's also entirely possible that we're looking at an extension of negotiations, which I think is going to be politically problematic for both governments and economically problematic for the Iranians. The Iraq situation comes, I think, at the worst possible moment for these talks, unfortunately. It will inevitably, I think, strengthen the suspicions of hardliners because of the reality of the threat that's emanating from Iraq. It will strengthen their position within the domestic power structure. It will strengthen their reluctance to go along with any sort of compromise on what is very much an existential security question for them, the existence of the nuclear program. It may also intensify their perception that they have some leverage over the United States, both with respect to actions on the ground in Iraq, but also with respect to the prospects for Iran to survive and, in fact, even thrive without a nuclear agreement. The only reason that the Iranians came to the table in the serious way that we've seen over the course of the past year was the devastating impact of international economic sanctions. And I think the interim accord's been a really useful period of testing for the Iranians. What they've seen is that, you know, even poking small pinholes in that sanctions regime, the modest sanctions relaxation they received as a result of this interim accord brought them very little in the way of real new investment on the ground, a lot of interest.
And have they responded to that realization by thinking, therefore, there's no point in doing business? Or have they responded to it by saying, therefore, we need to do what we need to do in order to get a much more comprehensive relaxation of sanctions?
I think it is, you know, force their attention on the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. They need this deal. They need the real sanctions relief. I think it means they're going to hold out for a hard bargain, something very different than those in Congress might be contemplating in terms of what the structure of sanctions relief will look like. But they absolutely need the economic openings and the ability to interact with the international financial system in something that approaches a normal fashion, which is what's been denied to them for the past couple of years as a result of these sanctions.
So you said that you thought that the Iranians might perceive that they have leverage as a result of the situation in Iraq and that may sort of embolden the hardliners in the nuclear context. But why shouldn't I look at it more optimistically and say, you know, you have this opportunity for sort of parallel cooperation, or at least, you know, that could operate as a demonstration project, that there are areas of substantial overlapping interests between Iran and the United States, and that this could have sort of positive spin-off effects in the nuclear context.
I think that really gets down to the question of timing. If this had come 6 months after a nuclear accord had been inked by both sides, and you know, that those issues were, if not behind us, were at least largely settled in terms of what each side's commitments were going to be. I think the difficulty is simply that it comes at the moment where we're looking for the Iranians to make the hardest compromises and to negotiate that at home within their own power structure. And if I'm an Iranian hardliner, I'm both averse to compromise, more averse to compromise today than I was before. The prospect of cooperation with the United States unnerves me and offends me. And I'm looking and seeing the possible disintegration of Iraq and the loss, potential loss of, if not Iraqi current oil exports, then at least the growth that was anticipated and that, frankly, is absolutely vital for the growth of the international economy over the course of the next 5 years, and say, this is my chance. This is my chance to come back from isolation. This is my chance to break out of these sanctions, and I don't need a nuclear deal to do it.
Where does the personality of Rouhani fit into all of this? Elected, everybody's talking about a sort of new wave of reform, and yet we've had a 20-minute conversation, and this is the first time his name has come up. Is he a driver of this? Is he a passenger? Is he irrelevant? Where does he fit in?
I think Rouhani is extremely important, and I think that the danger is in equating him to one of his predecessors, Mohammad Khatami, who came from a very different philosophical, political place, and a very different place in the Iranian security establishment. Remember that Rouhani was a deputy commander during the Iran-Iraq War. He is well integrated and well respected amongst much of the security bureaucracy. It's not to say he runs Syria policy or that he outflanks Qasem Soleimani and some of the others who are well known on these issues. But he has a greater degree of credibility in those communities. And he's also much savvier in the way that he approaches all of these decisions. So I think he has he's absolutely an important player on these issues. And I think what his focus has been has been to date on trying to get the nuclear deal done. In effect, he doesn't need this crisis either right now because he's trying to push through some compromises, and he's been empowered to do something, and this reduces the bandwidth. This creates a new set of, costs and benefits for the system to try to evaluate as it makes some decisions about whether or not to go for broke, whether or not to sign on to something in advance of July 20th, which I think is going to be a crucial and really interesting turning point for how this crisis goes and how Rouhani's government goes.
And why, dates come and go. Why is this date particularly important? I understand it's formally a deadline, but if the parties wanted to continue discussions and freeze things in place while they did, that's presumably doable. But you do seem to be attaching a lot of importance to the formal deadline.
I think there is a lot of importance because the Iranians will want more in terms of sanctions relief if they're going to continue to stay at the table, if they're going to continue to institute the freeze on particular activities that was part of the interim accord. What they've seen is that the sanctions relief they received as a result of last November's agreement has been modest, a few billion dollars and some openings on particular sectors that haven't, in fact, produced a lot of new investment or a lot of new trade. So they're going to be looking to crack those openings a little bit wider. On this side, if we fail to get an agreement by July 20th, it's going to be a big red flag to Congress, where there are already a number of proposals for new sanctions circulating, and I think that could potentially create some new obstacles. I'm optimistic. I'm probably the only optimist on Iran and Washington, but I do think that there will be a deal at some point. But July 20th was a useful forcing mechanism in particularly forcing the Iranians to come to the realization and sell that at home that they had to give up major aspects of their centrifuge program.
And just justify your optimism for a moment. Why should we look at this situation and say, where a deal is likely or probable.
I have the luxury of, you know, very superficial technical knowledge. And so if you had some of our colleagues here, Bob Einhorn in particular, who sat across the table from the Iranians for several years, they would have a much more pessimistic view. I look at this from a political perspective, and there's no other explanation. There's no other outcome for Rouhani's government. If they walk away from these talks, his administration is effectively sunk. He has no real influence at home. He has no real agenda to pursue. And he has no real prospect of reviving the Iranian economy. And all of the political risks that he took to get here will have been for naught. He really did sign on to some significant concessions in exchange for what was relatively modest sanctions relief. And that was a big risk. He did that before, and he was sent to the political hinterlands for 8 years under Ahmadinejad and excoriated in public, including by the Supreme Leader, on a very regular basis throughout that time. So there was a decision made to put him back in place, to empower him to get this deal. And walking away now would be absolutely irrational. And the one thing that the Iranians are, in their own sort of convoluted way, is fairly rational.
So over the next few weeks, what's the, in your judgment, best case scenario in the sort of Iraq and nuclear sphere? And what's the worst case scenario? What's the range of possibility here over the next few weeks?
Well, it's the Middle East. I don't know what there's a best case scenario. I mean, the best case scenario would be that over the course of the next round of talks that are upcoming between negotiators from Iran and the P5+1, that we begin to see evidence of real movement on the Iranian side with respect to the centrifuge issue. That would mean that a deal is imminent. That would make all other things, I think, easier, including the possibility of direct cooperation. I think the worst case scenario would be to see evidence that, in fact, the deal is still very much stuck, that the Iranian hardliners and the Supreme Leader are beginning to publicly denigrate the need for these negotiations and the utility of the negotiations, and to see the Iranians get involved in a more substantive way on the ground in Iraq, because that opens up all kinds of room for a regional conflagration that could spread.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Suzanne Maloney and to the folks in the Brookings studio. Our music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yan, whose recital in the Washington area is coming up this week. We still need your help spreading the word about the podcast. Billions of people out there in the world still living in the darkness. Help bring them into the light. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.